So a number of people I'm fortunate enough to have in my life as mentors and colleagues went and volunteered in the wake of the Haitian earthquake and came back just overflowing with stories about the ethical challenges they faced. And so I think that it makes sense to us all, intuitively and maybe in talking with friends and colleagues, that disasters, you know, clinicians who volunteer in the wake of disasters routinely do encounter ethical challenges, and these can cause tremendous moral distress and anguish. But when they come back, these are often just shared with colleagues, and they haven't necessarily made it into the literature in a systematic fashion. So as they were bringing some of these challenges up in meetings and conversations, I started to look into the qualitative literature about humanitarian medicine and saw at that point that most of the research that's been conducted with humanitarian aid workers has been done with people who've worked in post-conflict zones or people who have worked with programs that have sort of a longer track record in the field. And at that point, I became interested in seeing a little bit more about how the experiences of people working disaster relief were either distinct or how much they overlapped with these other things, if they had sort of unique aspects. So this is still in the data collection phase, and these are initial results. No relationships to disclose and no off-label uses. So working with the research the interviews I've conducted so far, I just am going to go over briefly the ethical challenges that are commonly associated with the delivery of disaster relief, identify perceived barriers and facilitators to ethical decision making, and then finally discuss briefly a possible policy strategy to address the ethical concerns of clinicians participating in these disaster relief efforts. So an important premise that I took to my research is that moral agents are individuals who make moral decisions, whether or not they recognize the moral issues that are at stake, and that all clinicians who engage in disaster relief are moral agents. And I think that the existing research, while it's incredibly valuable, hasn't necessarily placed the results within a framework of ethical decision making. And so it was important to me that rather than just cataloging the ethical impressions that clinicians were bringing back, we try to systematically organize them in a way that gave primacy to their moral agency and to understand not only how they perceive themselves as decision makers, but how we might be able to empower them as decision makers to make even better choices. So I've developed this model using the existing literature on ethical decision-making, both by individuals and people who are embedded in organizations. It's been informed by existing qualitative literature from humanitarian medicine, and now I'm working on revising it in light of my own research. So the idea here is that the environment gives rise to ethical issues, and then the decision-maker recognizes the issue, makes a moral judgment, establishes some sort of moral intent, and engages in moral behavior. People who have looked at this literature would be familiar with this as James Ress' four-component model for individual ethical decision-making. And then overlaid on top of this, there are these other factors that are, you know, the moral intensity, so the quality of the ethical question itself, whether this is how concentrated the effects are of the decision, whether it's the proximity that the clinician feels to the people who are affected. And that proximity isn't just proximity in space, it's proximity also maybe culturally or psychological proximity. And then there are clinician variables and aid organization and practice environment variables that can all affect how decisions are made and how people process the information that they're dealing with. And I should note, too, that this is really simplified in that we expect that there would be feedback loops. So once somebody engages in moral behavior, it will change the organization around them. It changes how they perceive themselves as ethical decision makers. And so this is a simplified version of how I think it really happens in practice. So the first part I'll focus on today is really this idea of interacting with your environment to identify ethical issues and challenges. And as I started to pour through the data that's been coming in, I think that it's important to sort of distinguish between a moral issue and moral discomforts. So a moral issue, as I think about it, is present when an individual's actions, when freely performed, may have harmful or beneficial consequences for others. And when you're talking with people, they give you the idea that they have some sense of autonomy, that they're making a decision affirmatively that has these effects on others. But then I noticed there were a lot of issues they talked about that I would call moral discomforts. So here these are instances in which clinicians clearly see their action as having a consequence for other people or parties, but they don't necessarily perceive their actions in terms of personal choice or volition. They feel much more passive in the situation. So an example of a moral discomfort would be in one of our interviews, somebody talked about how we knew the supplies were available, but because of an organizational policy, I couldn't use them, and so I had to tell the patients we couldn't do anything. But somebody who described a very similar situation said, well, and I would call this a moral issue, they said, well, we knew that supplies weren't immediately available because of a policy, so it was up to me to change the policy. I had to go back to my supervisors and talk with them about why we needed to change this. And I just want to distinguish here that I'm not looking at terms of this as objectively, I'm not looking for an objective sense of whether they really could or couldn't do something. It's about the subjective feelings of the person in the situation. And it's important to realize, too, that I think that this might actually have positive benefits if somebody sees themselves as passive. It might be self-protective in contexts where they don't have a lot of power, or maybe when they feel overwhelmed. And so it's worth thinking sort of about the benefits of this and if it's really advantageous or not. So in terms of the moral discomforts, based on the themes that are emerging so far, people were very disconcerted by the disparity of resources between their typical work environment. Generally, the people I've interviewed are working in hospitals as clinicians, and the aid work that they're doing, the inadequacy of resources they had available to them to do their work, and then just feeling like the stuff that they were doing was a drop in the bucket. They weren't doing enough to help the people that they were there to help. In terms of moral issues, I think some of the common and probably very predictable ones were allocating resources, whether between one patient and another or between current and future patients, balancing the needs of individuals against population needs. And here I would point out that we might think of this in terms of individual health and public health issues, which is definitely part of it. But there were some interesting things that came forward, too. Could we violate the rights of one patient, maybe taking a photograph of them without consent and then using that for publicity if we thought that that photograph would bring a lot of resources in for future aid work that they could then use to treat more people? Balancing patient versus caregiver safety. We had some really compelling stories about people who were maybe in surgery and there were aftershocks in the hospital. They had structural concerns and thought it might crumble around them, and so could they leave the patient who was under anesthesia in the operating room and vacate during the aftershocks, or did they need to stay there with the patient? Establishing practice standards appropriate to circumstances. So here we have people who know that there's not reliable electricity, but they have patients who might be ventilator dependent, and how should they think about caring for those individuals? Distinguishing between disaster relief and humanitarian relief. So these are cases where somebody maybe had an infant who came in with a congenital cardiac anomaly, and they felt like this problem existed before the earthquake, it was going to exist after the earthquake, it wasn't related to the earthquake. So how much should they consider taking care of that problem versus focusing on things that were truly disaster related? Assigning responsibility for complications in long-term care. These disasters are often typified by sort of these surgical incisions where people come in, they come out, and they wondered, well, if we leave somebody and they have external fixators on an orthopedic injury, who's supposed to take those out? And if there's an infection, who's supposed to address that later because there wasn't a long-term follow-up plan? And then finally, determining the extent of their professional responsibilities. So they saw patients whose lives were completely devastated by this, and they felt like they had this sort of mission was to take care of disaster-related medical needs. So this was like sort of the narrow part. But then they saw this constellation of other medical needs. How many of those did they need to address? And then realizing that people maybe didn't have a home to go to. They didn't have enough food. They didn't have a job that they were going back to. How many of these things were they supposed to address? Because they saw that as moral agents and individuals themselves, they could actually do quite a lot for these people, but then they equally had challenges that they had donors at home who were constraining what they were supposed to be doing, and they saw that gifts, for example, to help somebody with food or to help them take care of these other needs could be just incredibly disruptive to life among the patients, that it was maybe not actually helpful to be doing those sorts of things. So in comparing to the other literature, the qualitative literature on humanitarian medicine, I think a lot of these themes come forward, but the last three seem to be things that are more distinct in this field. So I'm looking forward to that. So in comparing to the other literature, the qualitative literature involved in humanitarian medicine, and so these issues, I think, are more distinctive here, but an interesting question I have and one that I don't have a good answer for is, are these just variations on themes that maybe haven't been reported elsewhere? I think that they probably are, and so it would be worth coming up with dialogue about how these areas can communicate with each other to come up with strategies. So next, I focus in on the barriers and facilitators to ethical decision-making, which I've highlighted here in the model. And rather than reading these all out, I'll just note that whether something is a barrier or a facilitator is incredibly contextually dependent, and I thought that this was really crystallized for me around examples people gave about whether there was a pre-existing or ongoing relationship between the clinicians working with them. And so in some cases, having a fellow clinician that they knew, maybe from working here in Boston before they'd flown down, they felt like that was a safe place to go. It was some place they felt like they could talk about challenges they were facing without having any sort of judgment. And at the same time, there were situations in which maybe they saw a coworker doing something they really didn't agree with, like posting patient pictures on Facebook or taking, making interventions they wouldn't have made. And they didn't feel like they could say anything there because they didn't want to poison the relationship when they got back to Boston. And so sometimes they felt like this was positive, and sometimes it was a very negative sort of situation. So taking into account the problems that they had experienced and then also looking at the factors that have been barriers and facilitators, the team at MGH has come up with this idea for dream teams, disaster relief, ethics, and management teams. And the hope there is that as a policy intervention, these teams can be pulled together before a disaster to work on planning, education, and training. Then during a disaster, they can provide ethics support services, primarily by clinician ethicists who can be there to offer feedback. An obvious challenge to this is that disasters don't provide a lot of time for reflection or emotional feedback, but it could still be useful, I think, in some circumstances. And then afterwards, to have a debriefing so that people can find emotional support. There were a lot of people who came back and just felt like they carried this sort of moral residue with them, and they had a lot of concerns that they were having a hard time shaking. And then the hope, of course, is this becomes a virtuous cycle where previous disaster relief efforts can inform future ones so that this can become better and better. So the goal of the Dream Team is to change the environment in ways that reduce the number of ethical issues that arise initially, hopefully to promote ethical decision-making by clinicians by addressing these different factors, and then to change the environmental and organizational factors in ways that facilitate ethical decision-making also. And I think that while it's an ambitious plan and one that I can definitely see some wrinkles in actually implementing, there's a lot of really good literature on ethics consultation, both in the clinical setting and in the research setting, that suggests that it is possible to have effects on cognitive, psychological, and domains of quality, where I think that the Dream Team could really target those and have a positive impact. So, great. Thank you so much. So I think that ethicists have really been involved in a lot of disaster planning in advance, and there's a good literature on, I think, the contributions they can make there. So I think that people don't necessarily need to have clinical training specifically in this pre-stage. I think on the ground there's enough concern about people who are diverting resources and not necessarily furthering the disaster relief mission that it would be good to have people on the ground who are also clinicians so they can sort of contribute in both an ethics support capacity and also contribute to the delivery of medical care. And then after, I think it's important not only to have ethicists involved in debriefing, but the idea is to involve people like social workers and counselors who can provide both sort of care for the disaster relief worker, but somebody who can take that information and incorporate it into the other, into future planning and education efforts.
But do you see that being different than like some of the mental health teams that are involved in monitoring disasters?
I think there would end up being a lot of overlap, and that's one of the hopes that's, it's the ethics and management, and the idea there is that there could maybe be some more cohesion. Another perceived goal or utility of this team is actually to coordinate between different disaster relief groups, because that was one of the ethical concerns, is that there just isn't good communication between teams on the ground, and so there's maybe duplication of services, or Clinic A doesn't have the drug that Clinic B does have, and if they had just known that Clinic B had it, they could have gotten the patient there in time to get it. And so the hope was that this would also provide a means of communication that way. So I've just focused on a narrow part of it, but I do think it would need to be multidisciplinary and have a number of roles on the ground.
Yeah. I'm a physician interested in the ethics related to elders with cognitive impairment and dementia, but also the intergenerational ethics that connects us to these big issues of global climate change. And my question to you is, you talked about choosing between patients, and you mentioned specifically children. Did any of your participants in the study speak of ethical dilemmas in relationship to either the care of older people in general or those with dementia, or specifically if they had any challenges where they were choosing between kids and elders, to make that specific point?
The people I've worked with have primarily, they either took care of primarily a pediatric population or they took care of more of an adult population. So I didn't so much encounter stories so far about people who were trying to decide between elders and pediatric patients. I did, though, you know, in the stories I can remember about sort of people who have some sort of cognitive impairment came more around death and dying, actually, and feelings about how you were supposed to bring family members in when that was really against the rules of the situation, to have these extra bodies that they were bringing into the clinics, and how you could really have somebody have a dignified death. And take care of them in a holistic fashion if they really were used to having family members and you didn't want them to be alone, but you didn't feel like you maybe had the infrastructure to support having another person there. So, we have time for one more? Okay.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on some of the characteristics of your subjects and where they worked, what were their positions and their assignment type of.
Yeah. So the people I've worked with so far almost all came from MGH, Massachusetts General Hospital, just down the street. And they went down and they were assigned to a variety of settings. So a number of them worked on the USNS Comfort, the Navy hospital ship that was down there. Some of them worked in medical centers that were really set up in tents, you know, these tent hospitals. Some worked in teams where they were really clumped together with a lot of coworkers, and some people worked in settings where it was much more ad hoc, sort of people who were flowing in. More doctors than nurses right now, only two nurses, which makes this a little bit different than other research in the field, which seems to be more skewed towards nurses in terms of the published data. And most of them were there for a period of about 2 weeks. Great, thanks.